Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is a newcomer to Chapel Hill. Well, he's not really a newcomer. A newcomer is a semi-permanent resident. Frank Bruni is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and now a professor of public policy at Duke University. And we'll get him to talk a little bit about basketball and about Carolina versus Duke. But first, we'd like to talk about his brand new book. Came out on the first day of this month. It's called The Beauty of Dusk, and it's about dealing with his challenges because of what I guess I'll call diminished vision and the possibility of going totally blind. Frank Bruni, we're hearing about you everywhere at Chapel Hill. Is it too late to welcome you back?
No, never too late to welcome someone. No, I appreciate the welcome.
Well, we're excited about lots of things that you're doing. A graduation speaker, upcoming sold-out event sponsored by Flyleaf Books in Carrboro.
Is it sold out?
Well, I tried to buy a ticket today, and it's sold out, yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure about that. If someone wants to come, they should at least try, but maybe it is. I apologize if it
no,
is.
No,
it's good, right?
Yeah, well, I would... You know, you like to have good problems. That's a good problem. I think we'd encourage people, and some people will be listening to this program after that event is over, but, you know, if you have a friend in high places, the folks at Flyleaf Books, if you're a big customer and or have friends there, call them and ask them to put you on the waiting list for Frank Bruni's appearance in Carrboro on Monday night. Thanks for doing all that, Frank. I want you to talk about your book, and the book is The Beauty of Dusk, on vision lost and found. Tell us about this book and why you wrote it and what that title means.
Sure. I should mention one other thing first, though. If anybody does want to tune into one of those sorts of bookstore-sponsored conversations about the book, I do apologize if the Carrboro event is sold out, but there are a bunch of events on my calendar that have limitless virtual tickets, and so if anybody wants to go to frankbruni.com, www.frankbruni.com, they'll find some events there that don't have an attendance limit. But the book. In October 2017, I woke up one morning, and my vision was not what it had been when I went to sleep. And there was a weird fog over the right side of my field of vision. And in a matter of days, I was diagnosed with a very rare condition known by its initials, NAION. I was told that I would probably never have functional vision out of my right eye again. My right optic nerve had been damaged overnight by a kind of stroke. And that has been the case. I have never gotten that vision back. And I was told that I would live with a significant risk forevermore of the same thing happening to my left eye, in which case I would be left legally blind. And the book, The Beauty of Dusk on Vision Lost and Found, is about how I processed that, what I went through after that, what I learned from that. It's about my own emotional, psychological, and medical journey, but it's also an account of people I interviewed. I decided to kind of put on my journalist hat and interview and try to learn from people who had early in their lives or before old age been confronted with serious physical and medical challenges, how they navigated those, what they learned from them. I wanted to capture that for the book, and I also wanted to avail myself of that wisdom. So that's the story of the book.
One of the great parts of your book is where one of your characters, I can't remember who, cited the wisdom in the newsroom is that when something happens to you, that's great because that's copy. And I wonder, if you, from the moment this horrible stroke that took most of the sight out of one of your eyes, did you say this is going to be a journey and I'm going to record it and I'm going to have a book out of it? Are you that crass?
No, I didn't. It's a great question. I didn't. Yes. So what you're referring to, and I Nora Ephron.
Yeah, Nora.
The great writer. Yeah, the great writer Nora Ephron, and filmmaker too. I was among the many blessings I've had in life during the last decade of her life. She became a close friend, and Nora had a saying which she kind of felt was like a journalist mantra, which is everything is copy. You know,
yeah,
nothing
yeah, that's
happens.
A quote. I couldn't find that quote this morning when I everything is copy.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, I don't know if you've ever, I mean, you can tell me if you've ever seen this documentary. If you haven't, I recommend it. Her son, Jacob Bernstein, one of her two sons with the journalist Carl Bernstein,
right.
After Nora died, he was very close to his mom, loved her very much. He made a documentary about her life, Call, and he called it Everything is Copy. And it's a fascinating film because part of what it mulls, and I've actually used this documentary in a first-person writing course that I teach at Duke, part of what the movie mulls is the whole question of why do we choose and not choose to write about certain things in our lives. I didn't, after this happened in those first weeks, as I entered a clinical trial if someone was sticking a needle in my eye to give me an experimental treatment, I did not think to myself, there's a book here. But I did think all along that at some point I wanted to approach what was happening to me journalistically, if only because that's the way I process the world. And then I wrote an essay when I was still a full-time op-ed columnist for the New York Times. I wrote an essay in February of 2018 about what I was going through. And at that point, several editors came to me or to my agent and said, hey, this really feels like a book.
Oh, wow.
And only then did I thought, okay, let's do a book.
Well, I'd love to hear about that because most of the authors that I talk to have to bang down the door to get their agent to get interested in it. And it's a great blessing when your agent calls us and says, I think we got something here. And it was a blessing for us. It did turn out. Let me, stepping back to the days after your stroke and the loss, the certain loss of sight, not certain that it was going to be permanent, but it was, you knew that it happened. One of the parts of the book, it wasn't easy to get an expert doctor to look at you.
I mean, no, you know, I'm so glad you brought that up, and I would really love to hear from you after I answer this about whether you've had this experience in your life, because I think we only talk a whole lot more than we do about our relationships with doctors and how to navigate those things. But, you know, I mean, here I was facing this completely scary and enigmatic thing. Why can't I see out of my right eye all of a sudden? And, you know, I got in to see my my normal eye doctor, the one who does my glasses prescriptions. I happened to know him well enough that I had his cell phone number in my cell phone, and I called him, and he saw me within hours. But he sensed correctly that I needed a much, much kind of more specialized specialist. I needed a neuro-ophthalmologist.
Oh, golly.
I never knew such a thing existed. You know, and he said, here's a really good one. You should go see him. And I called that person's office. And they're like, oh, yeah, we've got an appointment in 3 months. You know, now, when you've suddenly gone blind in one eye, you don't wait 3 months. And there's nothing, that doctor did nothing wrong. And certainly we've all experience during this pandemic that notion of having to wait a long time, but you do realize in a specific and in a general way, or at least I did, that the urgency that you feel and the urgency of your situation is not always and sometimes seldom mirrored in the urgency a physician feels, because that physician is taking care of dozens, scores, maybe hundreds of patients. And it taught me right at the start of this medical odyssey an important lesson. You have to take charge of your care. You have to be aggressive as a patient. You have to educate yourself and make sure you're asking the right questions, because you are paying more attention to you than anybody else in the healthcare system is going to. And if you don't realize that and act accordingly, you are shortchanging yourself. But I mean, I'm curious, you've no doubt dealt with doctors for different things. Does that resonate for you?
Yeah, but you're in, I guess in chapter four, somewhere along the way, you, in almost bold type, you said, you are your own case manager. You know, that we are trained, I think, to be passive with respect to dealing with the expert medical care that is available to us. And that, as you point out, and it made good sense to me, I just hadn't focused on it, is that although I'm not an expert doctor, I've got some things that the doctor doesn't have. I've got time. I've got the interest in this particular case. And I can, I'm, as you put it, I can be the case manager if I'm willing to do that. And it doesn't mean an adversarial relationship with the physician. It means I'm moving towards equality because I care more about it than anybody else could care.
I think you said, that's exactly right. You captured that perfectly. And I hope people listened to you carefully, because part of what you said that is so right on the money is we are taught to be passive. Like, they are the experts, we are the naifs. You know, they are the professors, we are the pupils. And that's true to an extent, but as you and I have just said, you know, we're in charge of ourselves and we care the most about ourselves. And if we don't speak up for ourselves, we're not gonna get the care that we need.
Well, we're gonna talk some more about that. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Frank Bruni, and we'll be right back after the short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Frank Bruni, a newcomer to Chapel Hill. Well, he knows a lot about Chapel Hill. He's been here a lot, but we're getting him on pretty much a full-time basis. And he's written a longtime columnist for the New York Times and now the author and author of many other books. Currently, the new book is The Beauty of Dusk, On Vision Lost and Found. Frank, you've told us about losing your vision. You want to talk about finding your vision in this context?
I do, thank you, because the book ultimately is less about the degree of it, the portions of vision I lost, than it is about how I was in many ways enlarged by the experience. I think that when you find yourself in these sorts of circumstances where events have taken form and you have been challenged or limited physically in a very profound way, you face a choice. You can focus on what you feel has been taken from you, on what you feel is your misfortune. You can focus on what you've lost, or you can make a decision to take the fork of the road that leads to what you still control, what remains, not your limitations, but your blessings. And that is a habit of mind, and that's a decision that I wish I had made or figured out earlier in life. This episode really taught me that you can, I mean, it's the old looking at the cup half full or half empty. For every bad thing that was happening to me, I could see a grace note. I could see a silver lining if I looked for it.
Frank, excuse me for interrupting. You make this quite clear in your book that this is, you know, that as a result of your experience and then as a result of lifetime, that's the kind of person you are. And weren't you that kind of person before this event that took your eyesight?
No, I was not. I was before this, I was someone who was way too prone to stewing in resentments and to taking stock of, you know, why, I mean, silly things. Why did my brothers tan in the sun and I burn? Why did I gain weight faster than pretty much anybody else in my family? Why me? And only when I had maybe the best reason of all to finally say why me, did I realize that the question we should all be asking is why not me? You know, because I really think if you look carefully, and this is the vision I found, DG, if you look carefully and honestly at the people around you, you realize that struggle is the default human setting. Mm. It's not an exception.
Well, you mentioned early on in your book, and then later on with poignancy, about how as a child you dealt with the growing realization that you were gay. And yes. And thought that one part of you was saying, well, why am I getting punished with this? And it seemed to me that in this book you'd already reassessed that and realized that was a challenge, but it worked out to be right and good for you. But did the experience with your eye reinforce that feeling that it wasn't, nobody was trying to play tricks on you or be bad to you or take unfair advantage of you?
Yeah, I mean, it reinforced for me that we are, and I should say about the gay stuff, you know, when I was growing up, it was the 70s, early 80s. And so much more so then than now, if you realized you were gay, you thought, wow, this could be a really tough life. And one of the things I'm most grateful for in my life, and one of the things I'm most grateful for about the arc of history, is we have made such strides and so much progress as a society that my life has not been made hard by being gay. But certainly as a teenager, I thought it would be. And for some people, it still is more than it should be. But, you know, the I thing was an echo of that in the manner that, you know, you're dealt a hand of cards in this life. And some of those cards are really good ones, and some of them are not the best ones. And you have no control over what that hand of cards is going to be, GG, but you have enormous control over how you play them.
Well,
and that's a lesson that was really hammered home to me as I dealt with vision loss.
Well, I want to get back to the vision loss, too, because it's a poignant and really interesting and inspiring part of your book. But you use the book to talk about some of us who maybe aren't exactly as we portray ourselves, and you call it sandwich boards. Can you tell us about sandwich boards and the point that you're trying to make with that?
I will, but I'll make you deal. After I describe my sandwich board theory of life, as I call it in the book, after I describe that, DG, will you tell me what's on your sandwich board?
I'll try. I knew you were going to ask me that. But I am such a sandwich board guy, I don't know what's inside. I mean, that's a topic for another day. Yeah, tell us.
Well,
about
okay, I'm going to tell you the sandwich board theory, and then I'm going to add them. We'll just see if you got something to put on your sandwich board. But I think a lot of us are prone to self-pity, and a lot of us feel bad about ourselves or our lot, or we envy, because we make assumptions about the people around us. We see somebody and we say, oh, that person seems so confident. They're on a glide path. They've got no troubles. We don't realize or look for the fact that the people all around us have struggles and troubles and pain that mirrors our own. And I say in the book, and I believe this, that if we all walked around wearing sandwich boards that briefly listed the harshest struggles that we've had in the recent past or what we're going through, we would realize that everybody is dealing with something. We would be way less prone to self-pity, and we would be way quicker to empathy. And it would be a kinder, gentler world, to borrow from, you know, the first President Bush, but it would also be one in which we had a more realistic sense of where we existed in relation to everyone around us. So people always look at me, DG, and they say, you know, I have enough more. I have a lot of vision left, and so I do not walk through the world with a guide dog or a cane or any visible manifestation of diminished eyesight. And people will always say to me, gee, you know, your eye looks okay. You look exactly the same. And I think, you know, if that's true of me, how many other people is that true of? How many people around us look just fine, but that facade, that's an artifice that masks pain, is that what would their sandwich board say? And I met and talked to people because I began asking questions I didn't before, who would be wearing sandwich boards that said something like, you know, when I told my family I was gay, I was rejected. I live with chronic back pain. 2 weeks ago, my spouse died in his 30s. That sort of thing. And so, Gigi, what would your sandwich board say? What can't people see about you that you struggle with?
I don't know. A lot of people know a lot about me, but other people would say, DG, why don't you just go put it on the sandwich board? I'm still grieving over my loss to John Edwards in the Democratic primary, Senate primary. And they would say, DG, you still hadn't gotten over that. Go ahead and just put it on your sandwich board so we'll know. I don't know. I mean, or on the other hand, what kind of image do you want to project? And that is that I'm a clean living, kind, reasonably smart person that you'd like to know. I mean, that's kind of what I put on my sandwich board, I guess.
But I'm guessing part of my point here is I'm guessing that, and if you're not, then you are a very, very blessed man. But I mean, I'm guessing that you are prone to moments of self-doubt, of self-questioning, that you do not always feel as assured or confident as you perhaps project to the world. I mean, isn't that the case for you?
I want to take a break because you nailed me. I'm talking to Frank Bruni. We got to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. This is D.G. Martin. Frank Bruni is my guest talking about his new book, The Beauty of Dusk. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Frank Bruni, new permanent resident of Chapel Hill, and the author of the brand new book, The Beauty of Dusk, which he's telling us about. Frank, maybe we better get away from the sandwich boards. You're pressing me on this.
Okay.
But
Whatever you want.
That's right. what does your sandwich board say?
If the briefest one says compromised eyesight might go blind. You know, I live with the possibility, at least as doctors understand it, of the 20% chance that, you know, I'll go blind. I've met enough blind people now, I've interviewed them, that I know that I will still have a rich life if that happens, but I would like it not to happen.
And yes.
That means I carry around traces of fear that I didn't before, and that makes each day a little bit harder.
So what you want us to know about you is that you let us know about it in the book, is that this is an important feature of your life, is that you're under Damocles' sword of possible blindness.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and it's not just a sword about the future, although that is, you know, that sword does dangle there. But I mean, I've had to make a lot of adjustments in the present. I can't read my profession is words. My profession is reading and writing. I can't read as quickly as I once did, or in chunks of time as extended as I once did. You have to do a lot of my reading on electronic devices where I can upsize the type and really control the backlighting. I used to not be able to listen to audiobooks at all. My mind would wander. I hated audiobooks. Now I'd say two of every three books I consume by audiobook, and I've gotten so good at it that I up the speed to like 1.7.
Oh, you do?
And I mentioned that. I mean, I'm sort of spinning us into a new direction, but I mentioned that because one of the things I learned through all of this, and one of the messages I really want to say loud and clear to people, is we as human beings are so nimble and so adaptable when we need to be, and that should be a source of great reassurance to everyone as they navigate life and as they think, I don't know what's coming down the pike, you know, I'm worried about aging. I had a very distinguished judge, a circuit court judge in D.C., who's been blind since his early 30s and has had, not just survived that, but has had a thriving, distinguished career. He said to me at one point when we were talking about all this, he said, starfish can regrow limbs, but that's nothing compared to what people can do. And he's right, and that should be an enormous consolation and source of strength for all of us.
He almost, your description of him in your book, I would really like to meet this guy, but I'm exaggerating, but because of his rich life and the rich lives of other blind people that you talk about in your book, you know, said, I've been cheated because I'm not blind.
I don't know if you remember. I mean, I fling a lot of people at you in the book, but I don't know if you remember. But do you remember the blind traveler in the book?
Oh yeah, he sees it better than anybody else because it's translated to him by the people who are with him.
Yeah, did you ever? I didn't. I mean, it's amazing that he's not a more famous figure. I'd never heard of him before I started researching.
What's his
blind
name?
Writers. But had you ever heard of him?
No, and I can't remember his name now. But a wonderful.
It's James.
Story.
It's James Holman, and he was. I forget time. Sorry, I think we're talking late 18th century, early 19th century. He. As his biographer recounted, he traveled more miles around the world than Marco Polo by multiple times. And he was a travel writer. He was a very famous English travel writer. And this sounds absurd, like some sort of comedian's joke, but he was perhaps the most famous travel writer of his day, and he was blind. And so when he wrote about the places he was going to, he was, to the extent that he described them visually, it was through other people's accounts. But he also wrote, you know, there was still so much available to him, the smells of a place, the sounds of a place, the legends of a place. And it's a really interesting lesson in how much is still available to us when a portion of our lives is taken away. There's still many portions of our lives, many, many perspectives and aspects left.
Well, along those lines, you'll be coming down here to the political season in Chapel Hill and in North Carolina, and a guy named Clay Aiken is running for Congress, I think. You have a story.
This is the American Idol, Clay Aiken?
Yeah, yeah, and you have a story about a guy named Cliff Magnus. I hit that name. We have a wonderful professor here named Jody Magnus, so I've stopped at Cliff Magnus. And what's the story there about blindness and talent with Cliff Magnus?
Well, with Cliff, actually, so there are blind people in the book. There are also people with multiple sclerosis, with Parkinson's disease. My interest was in people who had been dealt a physical/medical challenge and figured out, you know, how to not just survive that, but to thrive with that and all that. Cliff Magnus is a record producer and songwriter who, at the peak of his career, like shortly after he wrote much of and produced Avril Lavigne's first huge blockbuster album. And not long after, and I think he worked with Clay Aiken too, which is why I think you brought Clay Aiken.
Yeah, that's in the book.
But yeah. And shortly, like when he was at that peak, he at one point lost half of his face was paralyzed, and he lost his hearing in one ear. And in the same way, like I said, wow, I can't lose my sight. I read and I write for a living. I mean, his living was his hearing, was how good his hearing was his, you know, was music and the world of sound. And he was terrified, and he didn't know what was going to happen to him. And what he found, and this speaks to nimbleness and the brain's adjustments and to that whole notion that starfish are nothing compared to us, he found that his brain sort of rewired itself, and he adapted so that now, even though he only hears out of one ear, that ear perfectly tells him whether the sound's coming from the right or the left. It does what we have two ears to do, but it does it with one ear. And that's not some miracle story. That is perfectly emblematic of what the human brain can do when it has to.
Well, that, again, that's another story, which is the theme of your book, is that what's happening to you is not as bad as you think it is, and in some ways it might make you better, might make you better at what you want to do. Well, let's take another break. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Frank Bruni about his new book, The Beauty of Dusk, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Frank Bruni, not a newcomer to Chapel Hill, because he's been in and out of Chapel Hill all his life, but coming to Chapel Hill to teach at Duke. Frank, you can't do that.
I know. I've betrayed my alma mater.
No, it's the...
Do you think I'll ever be forgiven? DC,
I think
for
you will. If not,
and teaching at Duke.
If not, the crossovers are numerous, and if we ever went to war with Duke, it would be like the Russians are finding Ukraine. We find that there would be a lot of friendly people over at Duke who couldn't understand why we wanted to break war on them, because we're all basically pretty much the same. It's but it is interesting, and as we talk, that we're getting ready for the annual Carolina at Duke game to end the season, and all of those things that Will Blythe brought to us in his classic "To Hate Like This to Be Happy Forever." I don't know if you've ever read that book. If not, I'm going to give you a copy when you get back down here.
No, I never read it. Yeah.
One of the interesting things about your book that I'm not sure you dealt with it as much as I'd like for you to, but early in the book, you mentioned that one of the damning things about your stroke is that you might be predisposed to have another one. In fact, I think one doctor said maybe could be as many as 40% chance that you'd have another. But they said, nothing happens to you after, I think, 2 years, that risk recedes. Do you believe that you are less likely to have another stroke because you've done so well over the last now 3-4 years after your stroke?
Yeah, the answer is I don't know and no one knows. This condition is just rare enough that the body of statistics about what happens to people is not a robust or reliable one. So, I mean, I have learned that while there are bits of conventional wisdom, there are no hard and fast answers. There are some doctors who believe that the longer the period of time after a stroke that devastates one optic nerve, the longer period of time after that, the less chance that a similar stroke will damage the other optic nerve in the other eye. But there are also doctors who say, you know, we just don't know at all. And, you know, there's divergence of opinion to the point where the first doctor I saw said there's a 40% chance it'll happen in your other eye. And I learned fairly quickly thereafter that most doctors put that at 20% and some put it at 15%. So no one knows. I've heard, you know, when you have any sort of public presence like I do and you write about this stuff, you get a lot of emails from people who are like, oh, I have that condition, whatever. And I have absolutely encountered people through my inbox, through email, who have had it happen to one eye and then the second eye 10 years later, 15 years later, 20 years later. So I do not and probably will never feel that I'm out of the woods. And I think that's good because I think we all should live with the recognition that, you know, something bad like that could happen, and we should seize our pleasures while we can. We should count our current blessings and not take anything for granted.
Well, I'd like to talk some more about that as well, but I can't stop talking to you without talking about your love interest, and that along the way after your stroke, you fell in love with a dog named Reagan in 2019.
you make it sound a little pervy, DG, but yes, I am.
Well, wrote that, so I would have.
I wrote it that way. No, you're on completely fair. Well, first tell me, like, before I sing the praises of my dog Regan, are you a dog person?
Well, I love dogs, but I don't have one right now. The dogs that I've had, I've loved, and I'm newly moved into a retirement home, I guess, and I'm surrounded by these people my age who have loving relationships with their dogs, and it's very tempting. But right now, I've just said, I'll take care of your dog anytime you want me to. But yeah.
Well, that's sort of great. That's sort of like for me being an uncle. I can kind of borrow a kid whenever I want, but I don't have full responsibility. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, among the sort of difficulties of what I went through, right around the time this happened with my eyes, right, a 10-year relationship ended.
I can't talk. Yeah. I mean, we can't go into that, but that is one of the most poignant parts of your book is.
Thank you. I think thank you. But I was alone, and I mean, I didn't feel horribly lonely. That wasn't the thing. But I did feel like I did not want to become self-consumed. I think when something extraordinary happens to you, like what happens to me, something extraordinarily challenging, I think it's easy to get very self-consumed, and I don't mean self-consumed in a good self-care way. I think you can get self-consumed in a bad, self-pitying way. And I just had this kind of instinct that I needed to do something or should do something that would take me outside of myself, and that I should do something that represented kind of yanking some joy into my life. And I've always loved dogs. I've had them in the past. I hadn't had one in many years. So I pleaded and cajoled my younger brother to give me his dog, his rescue dog, whose name is Regan. And he and his wife had just become empty nesters. They were doing a lot of traveling. So So they were not perfect caretakers of their dog any longer, and I promised them I would give Regan an amazing life. And I believe, DG, I have kept that promise, but she's a wonderful, wonderful dog, and she's the source of enormous joy, and she has helped me get through this. And if you're a Chapel Hill resident, you may well have run into us because we walk all over the place. If you're in the woods on trails, you've probably seen us. She's the really gorgeous dog that's black with white paws. And I'm the schlumpy man beside her.
Well, I wanted to ask whether Regan likes the Copa Arboretum as much as she liked all the things in Central Park.
She's been to the Copa Arboretum, but that's kind of small. It's kind of small. Central Park. We live with access without kind of going over any major road to Carolina North Forest. You know,
Great.
So we spend a lot of time in Carolina North Forest on both sides of Sewell School Road. So, I think she likes it maybe better than Central Park because it has deer. And she sees a forest full of deer the way a teenager sees a Pac-Man video game. It's just, you know, pure stimulation and strategy. And, you know, it's great.
That is interesting. What, I let you know earlier, I'm interested in politics, and I got to know a friend of yours, Bob Carey, while I was involved in politics. Why do you like him so much?
Oh, I adore Bob Carey. I mean, I'll try to tell the story quickly, but I met Bob Carey in the course of doing a column about him about 10 years ago.
I'm going to interrupt you. I'm really sorry because I know who he is, and for 10 or 15 years ago, almost everybody thought he might be president someday. He's a Vietnam veteran who lost his foot and managed through that, which you deal with wonderfully in your book. So, but I shouldn't have sprung Bob Carey on you without helping the people who are listening to us remember who he is. So keep going, and I apologize.
No apology. You're right. We should probably actually fill that in a little bit more. He was a 1992 candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination the year that Bill Clinton got it. And he was the governor of Nebraska and the esteemed senator from Nebraska. And in 2012, the Democratic Party recruited him, convinced him to kind of come out of political retirement and run for the Democratic Senate nomination from Nebraska again. Nebraska by then had become a very red state, but they thought if anybody can turn that seat blue, it's Bob Carey, because he's such a beloved Nebraskan figure who was in the Senate from Nebraska. And so he went back there to campaign, and that was at the height of the push for marriage equality, for same-sex marriage. And I didn't know him at the time, but I learned that he was all across Nebraska building into his stump speech his support for gay marriage. And I also learned that way back in 1996, when Bill Clinton had signed the Defense of Marriage Act, which was an anti-gay marriage thing, Bob Carey had voted against that and had voted in a pro-gay marriage way. And so I found his phone number, and I called him up, and I said, Senator Carey, before I knew him, back then I couldn't say Bob. I said, I'd really like to write a column about the fact that you are mentioning this as part of your stump speech in Nebraska, even though in Nebraska this is not going to help you. It's obviously a point of principle for you. I want to understand that. And he said, great. And this was not in his political interest to get elected from Nebraska, even in 2012.
Absolutely not.
And he said, great, let's do it. And people on his staff kept trying to cancel the interview because they knew it wasn't politically wise. And Bob Carey kept overruling them and rescheduling the interview because this was a point of principle for him. And this will be familiar to you, DG, because you've been around like I have. I've been around long enough to tell you that those moments when a politician stands on principle in a way that is truly potentially injurious to their political career, these are not frequent moments. And that filled me with a respect for Bob Carey that then led to a friendship, because I later learned just what a warm and sharing person he could be. And I learned that over many tequilas through time. But he's a great guy.
Oh, Frank Bruni, we got to stop because you're busy. And I want to thank you for taking time to visit with your new neighbors in Chapel Hill. If you did join us late, our guest, wonderful guest, has been Frank Bruni. And we've been talking about his brand new book, The Beauty of Dusk. Thanks, Frank. We're looking forward to having you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to chat with me. And I want to thank the people of Chapel Hill for being so welcoming, being my neighbors.
We look forward to having you as our neighbor for a long time. Thanks to everyone. This is D.G. Martin who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.